Courage is not the absence of fear, but it is our ability to say what is necessary or to do what needs to be done despite having that fear. It's our ability to resist fear and to master fear. Today on the dojo, we're going to talk about courage and fear. Welcome to the dojo. So in the last episode, we did talk about fear, and we talked about what it is and why it's important to name it, claim it, and understand it. And we talked about the different types of fear, especially as it pertains to disability. And on today's episode, we're going to get into how we can face our fears and work through our fears with courage and bravery. And this really comes from what work has been, you know, I've kind of seen in my life to work. Again, I'm not a professional psychiatrist, psychologist myself. And so please know that this is coming from a place of somebody that's still working on this. I haven't have this mastered myself. I still have a lot to learn. And I'm going to share with you some of the things that I've found useful. I hope that you do too as well. But I'm learning myself. And so please know that this is coming from a place of acknowledging that. The things that I've really found that is helpful for me is seeing that courage isn't something that we're born with. That courage is kind of like a muscle that we develop through working out and over time. I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt that said, "Do something every day that scares you." And I feel like that quote kind of points to this notion that courage isn't something we're born with, it's something we got to develop. It's kind of like going to the gym. You know, it might not be the thing that we want to do, facing fear and having to then be courageous and say what's necessary or do what's necessary. It might not feel good, like it doesn't feel good necessarily to work out. It can kind of hurt physically. And it can kind of hurt psychologically when we exercise our courage muscles in the face of bravery. So I really feel like that's a helpful metaphor for me, is that courage is like muscles. We got to really, you know, strain it and tax it and use it and do it every day, like Eleanor Roosevelt was saying, you know, to face that and to be able to do it and to, you know, to conquer the fear is to face the fear. And it's kind of something for me that I'm learning to do one step at a time. I think it was Marcus Aurelius that said, "Don't let the whole sweep of life overwhelm you." I'm paraphrasing there, of course, but you know, I think it's this notion to where one of the things that can be debilitating to me is when I, you know, look at all the different things that may cause fear for me, understanding what's the meaning of life, fear that I might have with raising children, being in a committed relationship. My role as executive director for a Center for Independent Living, for being a good friend, a good family member. I start going into all these buckets and things that might cause fear and all of those and then aggregate it, and it just can be overwhelming. And so for me, in facing fear, I really hold on to this notion of, you know, one thing at a time. Don't let the whole sweep of life and all these different buckets of our lives come together as one, because that for me can be debilitating. I find myself as I'm, you know, working the muscle of courage, you know, not trying to have courage across the board in all those different buckets all at one time. So for those of us that are into like learning how to be more productive in our lives, there's this notion that there's no such thing as multitasking. You know, we can't try and do everything all at once. It's become more known now as task switching. Like we can only do one thing at a time. And if you may, maybe we're switching between one thing to another throughout our day, but we're not doing more than one thing at a time. So for me, that's been a helpful kind of mental device to help me just focus on what's in front of me, one breath at a time, one step at a time. All of this, too, is something I try to encapsulate in terms of facing fear is a positive thing. You know, it might not feel good, but it's an opportunity to get stronger. It literally, to me, is the dojo for life. and is something that I try to see as just being very positive. I've started to pull on here, and I'm going to continue to pull on, is, you know, ways to face fear that is more or less ways of seeing fear. It's more cognitive and using logic and reason to beat fear. I want to say as a caveat here, I probably should have said it at the beginning before I started diving in here, but I think one of the really good ways of addressing fear for me is behaviorally. So I think this is why I love physical activity. So fear elicits this, you know, stress response, and to then go do physical activity for me is a really great way. Nutrition creeps in there, so does sleep. We've had other episodes that are exclusively on those behaviors, and I reference those episodes for you because that's a behavioral way of addressing it. So today I'm pulling on the thread of logic and reasoning to help face some of these fears and with courage and to overcome them. And so another way for me of doing this is to ask myself questions as I'm feeling fear. And I have some standard questions that I like to ask myself to help really, you know, use logic and reason to get through this. And one question I ask myself is, what type of greatness or, you know, improvement in life comes without having to face fear? You know, I think about all the times where I've evolved or I've become better, or it's easier for me to see this in other people, where, you know, what business ever got started that is just an amazing business that's doing very well without somebody having to face the fear of, you know, losing money or having their idea panned or mocked by others? You know, what leader hasn't had their critics? You know, what person who has gained sobriety hasn't faced the fear of succumbing to their addiction? Where has greatness ever been achieved, whether it's in our individuals or in society or in business or in any other realm, without fear being a part of the mix? And so for me, again, it's a positive thing if fear is involved, because it, for me, it's a compass that shows there is improvement, there's a greatness to be achieved, because fear is kind of showing this. And to be brave and courageous, it doesn't happen unless there's fear. For me, they got to accompany one another. If we don't have fear and we're doing things, you know, it's not necessarily courageous or brave. In order to be courageous or brave, fear, for me, as I see it, has to be in the mix. So I see those as virtues. You know, courage, you know, is one of the cardinal virtues of Stoicism, and it's arguably by many the necessary virtue for all the others. So how can we exercise justice without courage? How can we exercise wisdom without courage? How can we exercise moderation and temperance within our lives without courage? How can we exercise humility without courage? You know, this idea that we're always wanting to learn that which we do not know. We have to be willing to look, you know, not smart to other people, because if we don't know something, we've got to ask questions. And yeah, by asking questions to others, they may view us as, you know, stupid or not knowing. And we got to be okay with that. Okay with the good opinion of others being that we're not the brightest out there. But if we want to learn, we got to be willing to kind of accept that. And again, it goes to this notion that I cannot be brave or courageous unless I'm in a state of fear. I also, like, when I'm feeling fear, I like to ask myself, as I'm having thoughts that cause the fear, I ask myself, who is in charge? The thoughts that I'm having or the one that is thinking those thoughts? I really try to get into a place where I separate my thoughts from who I am. And this really helps me to give some distance to the thoughts. I don't have to be my thoughts. I might have a thought of, oh my gosh, what if, blah, blah, blah. And I can step out of that and say, do I accept this thought, or do I move and change that thought to another thought? You know, I'm in charge here. Who's the I am that's in here? I'm the thinker. I don't have to be the thought. And how many of us have thoughts, whether it's fear, envy, jealousy, or anger? Just because we're having the thought doesn't mean that we necessarily have to attach our identity to that thought. Creating that space, creating that separation, gives me at least this opportunity to have agency in being able to determine, how am I going to think? How am I going to feel? I'm the one in charge, not necessarily the thoughts that are coming in incessantly all at one time. Another question that I like to, you know, ask myself as I'm navigating the ocean and waters of fear is that if I'm coming up to a point where I got to make a decision about, am I going to do something or I'm not going to do something, and I might have some fear about it, I ask myself what Hillel asked in the 18th century, a Jewish rabbi: if not me, then who? If not now, then when? This is really like grounding for me. So the first part of that, if not me, then who? If not me, then who? How many times have situations been left to resolve by other people? The quote unquote kicking the can down the road and leaving this decision for other people to have to make, the hard decision of, you know, having to cut costs in a business, having to address, you know, serious environmental concerns, having to address marginalized groups of people and saying the things that might be unpopular. If not me, then who? And I sometimes think about this in the simplest things too, like on the way to work today, I saw some garbage on the side of the street. I could have easily biked by it and said, you know, that's for someone else. But then I start thinking, like, if not me, then who is it going to be? Is it going to be anybody? Is it going to get blown into the, you know, rain gutters and just be environmental trash that's out there? And so that question gets me to stop, pause, and put it away. And maybe that's, I can have fear that, oh my gosh, I'm going to be late, or, you know, this, that, and the other. But, you know, this also reminds me of a time that was well documented where someone was being physically assaulted in a major urban area. And there were like 50-ish, you know, people, tenants in an apartment building that could hear it happening outside their apartment building. And no one responded to this person that was being brutally assaulted. People were thinking it was going to be somebody else that was going to respond to this. People ignored it too, turned up their TVs so they didn't have to hear it. Didn't want to interfere because perhaps potentially then they would become, you know, the victim themselves. Thinking it was going to be left up to somebody else, and no one responded. And this person was killed. And many people heard it and were interviewed afterwards. It's a classic study. And if we don't become the ones to stand up to bullies, if we don't become the ones to advocate for the needs of others who don't have the voice, then who's it going to be? If not now, then when is the second part of that. And that, to me, draws into this notion of procrastination. As Stephen Pressfield puts it, it's not that we say that we're not going to do it. It's just that we say that we're going to do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes and we say the same thing. So we say that, well, it's not that we're not going to do it. We're going to do it. We're just going to do it tomorrow. And then the next day comes and it becomes this endless cycle of lying to ourselves, saying that we're going to do it, but never do it. I don't know how many times I've said on this podcast, but if someday was a road, it would lead to the town of nowhere. And so we fool ourselves and we kid ourselves. And if not now, then when is a very important for me to the end my procrastination of fear. And for me, that's a coping mechanism to fear, is to procrastinate or to leave, as I was alluding to earlier, up to somebody else to do. And again, that just kicks the can down the road that leads to the town of nowhere. I like to ask myself those reflective questions that can snap me, you know, out of those kind of things. And another thing that I like to do to use logic and reason to really address some of the fears that I might have is fear setting. So, you know, fear setting is I think, a term coined by Tim Ferriss, a very popular, wildly popular influencer, who I think was kind of pointing towards the practice of premeditatio malorum. So meditating on all the different things that can go wrong, not to manifest bad energy, not to self-sabotage, but to objectively be ready for anything that could go wrong, that may go wrong, you know, kind of like a Murphy's Law kind of way, not to elicit worrying or anxiety, but to fortify ourselves, to be prepared for any scenario that might come up to be the worst case scenario. And so that really means got to name the fear, got to see the fear, got to anticipate, well, what will happen if the worst case scenario does manifest itself? How would I be able to handle myself in that situation? What would I do? Could I still live? Would I be willing to, you know, be able to get through these consequences? One of the times that I believe I did that long before I heard what fear setting was is when I got a job working at the VA for the Center for Innovation and Disability Rehab Research, a very phenomenal center. And it was during my postdoc work. And these were just like highly productive, seasoned researchers that were like, you know, had like, you know, millions of dollars in funding, track record of just doing amazing work and research. And, you know, I'm pretty wet behind the ears and coming in. And most new people didn't last long there. It was only a couple of years. And because it's a very, not the highest success rate. And it's not because like the center isn't super supportive or anything else like that, but achieving in research and academia and doing these kind of things and getting funding, it's a hard business. And I, you know, had 2 years to really be successful and to prove myself there and to do the kind of things that were there. And I remember going all in and doing the very best I could. And at the same time, being ready for if it didn't succeed, you know, what were going to be, you know, my alternatives and how would I be able to psychologically, emotionally, socially, I had new baby, you know, newborns in the house and mouths to feed and et cetera. And when it did get to the couple years being up and, you know, it not necessarily being a viable option moving forward, I was more fortified for the next steps and chapters in my life than I would have been if I hadn't gone through the exercise of fear setting and just visualizing what will happen if. And so that was very helpful for me. I think it was Napoleon, you know, that said like all commanders of an army should be anticipating at any moment asking themselves the question, you know, what if my enemy showed up to my right, to my left, to my rear, to in front of me at any moment, were to engage me from this direction and that direction? And it's been said, at least in the armed forces, one of the most unacceptable excuses is that I was not ready for that. I did not think that way could happen. So they do plenty of fear setting there in the sense of trying to really anticipate those things. And so do first responders. And thank goodness that they do. You know, one of the other things I like to do to help use reason and logic to address some of the fears that I have is look at my past experiences and look at yours that you might have had where you've had fear and you faced it and you got through it. Even if it was worst case scenarios might have manifested itself and you got through on the other side of it. Or if, you know, they never materialized and that are worst case scenarios and fears that I've said on previous episodes that oftentimes that we will suffer more in fear than the actual reality of the situation that we might be fearing. And how much time ahead of time do we spend in worry and anxiety? And it's almost more of that than it actually is than the lived experiences that we are fearing. And so I can look at the past and know that this too shall pass. So powerful, those words. Those four words can just really help to ground me into the temporal situation. It's temporary. This too will pass. This too will pass, and there will get to a time where we'll be on the other side of it. To have patience, to have endurance, to have perseverance, that even in the most fearful times and the worst case scenarios that might be manifesting themselves, there will be an opportunity to get on the other side of that. So looking at my past and seeing the times where I've either conquered fear or the worst case scenarios happened to manifest itself, still got beyond it, still got past it, most times became a better person for it. So as I'm going through fears or worst case scenarios or those other kind of things, really relying on the past as evidence that, you know, this too shall pass. Reframing fear is another thing that I like to do. I have a lot of experience in teaching, and every time going into the classroom, I like lots of years of teaching from kindergarten through college and you know, even today, having many times of where I'm going out and, you know, doing public speaking and all these other kind of engagements. And despite all of the times that I have doing that, there is what I would call like a heightened state of alertness. I used to call it nervousness. You know, again, public speaking is one of the most common fears, the highest ranked, head to death sometimes, as Seinfeld likes to joke, yeah, that we would rather be the person in the casket than given the eulogy. But this is a real fear that many people have, and it can be identified and labeled as nervousness. And I remember the good advice that I was given one time from another great teacher who always, you know, got it before those times that they would teach. They said, I call it being excited. And just reframing it, renaming it, you know, as something else was so powerful to me. And I was like, yeah, because, you know, there's things that I like to do that I find leisurely and recreational elicits excitement, whether it's taking a roller coaster ride, whether it's surfing or snowboarding or doing something exciting, it gets my heart rate up, it gets my alertness going, and it is kind of like a nervousness, but a nervousness does the same thing. And so physiologically, it's the same thing, but the word psychologically that we label to it can elicit different feelings. So reframing fear has been really helpful for that. And as I alluded to earlier, reframing fear is like not a bad thing. It's a compass pointing us in the direction of where we need to go. You know, it could be, you know, something that gives us clarity, saying, yes, this is something that's showing me that this direction's outside of my comfort zone, and knowing that that is where growth happens, is outside the comfort zone. And it's also reframing fear is, again, is a positive thing for me. It helps me be more present in the moment. Be here now. Fear can be one of those things that, like, it immediately is this light of consciousness to bring me, centering me and grounding me in the present moment. Because for me, that's what unlocks me getting out of the fear, is not just to be lost in thought and in the future of worry and the past of regret and in the fear that might manifest itself from those kind of things, but rather it helps me, like, okay, I'm feeling fear. I need to be really conscious of my thoughts, to separate, again, as I said earlier, the thinker from the thought, and to be here now. And so, wow, reframing fear is a great opportunity to be mindful, to be in the moment, to be fully conscious. And then, so again, reframing fear and, you know, it's being a positive thing. Another thing I like to use reason and logic to do is to not over catastrophize fear. So easy for me to start spinning, if I'm especially not conscious and present in the present moment, to really go down rabbit holes and catastrophize fear, make it more than it really is. And that's kind of, I'm alluding to what I opened up earlier with in terms of saying that if I let the whole sweep of life and all the different buckets that I have roles and responsibilities in, if I aggregate them all at once, seeing the 1,000-mile vision of all those different things, that's when I can start over catastrophizing fear. But there's this story of, you know, Ulysses S. Grant, like a very brave person in terms of combat and battle. But early on in his career, there's a story where he and a more veteran, I think, seasoned person, they were in a situation where they had to hike like 70 miles to get back to where they needed to get back to. This was, you know, in the frontier, and all kinds of dangers were out there. And one of the, you know, as they were hiking through the night, they heard wolves. And the person that Grant was with said, "How many do you think there are?" And Grant accounts that, you know, he didn't want to sound, I guess, weak or anything else like that, or this, that, and the other, based on the amount of fear that he had by hearing those wolves, he said at least 20, thinking that he was maybe even underestimating that. And as they went along, they encountered the source of the noise, and it was two wolves. It was two wolves. And they stood their ground, Grant and this other man, and they, wolves backed off. But the idea that the lesson that Grant took from this was that there's always more until they're counted. There's always more until they're counted. So how many times am I feeling fear and catastrophizing fear and thinking that there's more to fear than the fears that are really present in there? And that's an illusion. It was an illusion that there were more than two wolves. They thought there was many more wolves out there. And so how many times am I feeling fear in my own life that I'm making more out of that fear than there actually is? So over catastrophizing the fear can be something that for me can be really debilitating. And so I always like to think there's always more until it's counted. Another thing that I like to do in terms of using logic and fear is, again, like I said earlier, really naming and claiming the fear. Is the fear based on insecurity that I might have about myself? Is it based on loneliness? Is it based on what others might think? And this here, I think, is one of the most common areas of and sources of fear that we have in our modern day society. is the fear of the opinion and of others. And we definitely seem to be in a time that's divisive, but we're dividing up into different tribes, whether it's politically, racially, by religion, by where we live, geographically. There's so many different ways that we can, I think is referred to as tribalism. And we can get really compartmentalized into our tribes. And then once we're in these tribes and we're into these cliques, you know, we don't want to be ostracized from this tribe. The ancient times and the Greeks and the Romans, they would exile people. And this would be like one of worse than death for many people, because you were then kicked out of your tribe. You didn't have a social group to affiliate with. In our modern days, it's cancel culture. You're now canceled away from this tribe you once affiliated with. And why do we exact this punishment on people? Because we are evolutionarily wired to need each other, to be a part of each other. The number one, you know, fear is rejection. The number one need is acceptance. This can be weaponized. You know, so if you're a part of a political group, you know, unless you believe all 10 of the talking points and ethos of the political group, you could be ostracized. Maybe I believe 7 out of the, you know, 10. And these 3, I'm kind of like, you know, that could get you canceled nowadays. And if you're not having all the different talking lines of groups that, you know, may think a certain way, you know, and you just have any kind of nuanced opinions about other things, we're threatened with this exile. We're threatened of being canceled. And so when we value the opinions of others more than our own opinion, yeah, that can cause a lot of fear. I think it was Abraham Maslow that said, self-actualized people are free from the good opinion of others. So for me, facing fear means to value my own opinion or my own thoughts more than what the tribe I associate with is, or even the greater society, or even the greater culture that's out there. Florence Nightingale was trapped in this for a while. And she went on to become one of the most powerful influencers in healthcare. She became a nurse and was credited for really being the force that helped to found the International Red Cross. She received the calling to be a nurse when she was around 16, but ignored the call for 8 years. She got the call and desire to be a nurse again, you know, when she was 24, ignored the call for another 7 years. Why? Well, she was born into privilege, into the Victorian age, a lot of wealth and prestige, and the opinion of her family and her parents was basically summarized by them saying they would rather her be a prostitute than a nurse. And she didn't listen to this call to become a nurse, because of the opinion of her family and to not wanting to be on the bad side of them. And it took her a long time to hear the call, and thank God she did. You know, that fear kept even someone like Florence Nightingale at bay. So how many times are, you know, where in our lives, where in my life am I not heeding the call to fulfill the purpose or mission that, you know, I may have in my life because I'm worried about what other people might think, especially the people that I care about and love. It's hard. It's not easy. And so the good opinion of others. And then I think we need to really examine the opinion of others and their points of view. That I think it was mentioned in Fight Club that we end up doing things and wearing clothes and buying products and driving cars and saying things because we want to impress people, even people we don't like. Where does that come from? This need, you know, to be accepted, you know, by others, even the people that we do not like, you know, and two, like the illusion of all this, you know, I think is interesting. So there's this quote that says, you know, I am not who I think I am. I am not who you think I am. I am who I think you think I am. Let's say that again. I am not who I think I am. I am not who you think I am. I am who I think you think I am. How many of us are living, saying, doing things that are based on what we think other people are thinking about us? It's been said that we cannot know our own reputation. We may project what other people may think of us, but that oftentimes is a false reality and it's a false illusion. And I check myself constantly. Like, am I behaving are saying things, doing things, making decisions for my life, my life and my family based on what I think other people are thinking about me and what they will find as impressive or valuable. And so I can be seen as favorable in their eyes. Oh, it's a serious check for me to be able to really examine that, to not live my life from what I assume the point of views of other people are. It's just a false reality. And being at the mercy of critics and people that have gossip or blame or complain, you know, it can be very hard. And at the same time, I think that is a tax of, say, being a leader. What leader isn't going to be criticized? If you want, or I want to be in a position of being a leader, then I got to be willing to be able to take criticism from other people. If I'm not able to do that, if I have an ego, if I'm going to get offended, if I'm going to have to fight fire with fire and be critical of them and complain and gossip and be like them, I'm not going to be a good leader. If I want to, you know, have a bold idea or take a moral stand, there are going to be people that are going to criticize. I got to be okay with that and not run away from that. If I want to make a commitment of the heart, I got to be okay with looking foolish to others. And so I find that, you know, it's helpful for me to understand that that just comes along with the territory. It's a tax of leadership. It's a tax of having a bold idea that can be different from the mainstream type of thinking that's out there. It can be what comes along with having heart, taking a stand. And so that to me is helpful in helping to abate worrying about what other people may speak, you know, and talk about. And how can we ever talk truth to power if we're worried about the good opinion of other people and what they might think? So for me, that's very helpful into overcoming the fear of what other people think. And that I find to be, you know, one of the most prevalent and common fears in my life and to overcome. And I find that in other people's lives for many of the reasons that I've said before. And the last reason or form of using logic and reason and all these other kind of things to help me overcome fear, at least, is having good role models in my life that I can see that, man, they've lived a courageous life or they've done things that have helped me. And they're certainly like these superhero role model, you know, type figures that I can put out there that I can point towards, you know, Martin Luther King taking stands, Joe Lewis doing some of the things that they did in the face of violence and persecution. There's so many types of people that have put their rear end on the line, like literally, and taking, you know, the stands that they are taking in the face of tyranny that I can point to. I think it was Teddy Roosevelt that was the first president, sitting president, to invite black person, Booker T. Washington, to the White House. And he hesitated with extending this invitation. And it was because he hesitated. It was because he had fear that he did it. And he knew he was going to pay like a real high price. And so he was definitely taken to the cleaners by the press and by a lot of the people that once supported him. And, you know, he experienced his own form of cancellation over that. You know, and I think it was when Martin Luther King got arrested in the 60s that his wife, Coretta, you know, Scott King, you know, called Nixon, who was running against President, you know, then soon to be President John F. Kennedy at the time. And Nixon was supposedly a friend of Martin Luther King's and asked him to please intervene, help him get out of jail. He'll either be beaten or murdered while he's in there. And Nixon didn't intervene. But John Kennedy did. And John Kennedy, you know, helped to get him out of jail. And so did his brother. And they didn't hesitate. They did those kind of things. And there was a very narrow margin of victory for John Kennedy against Nixon in 1960. It's largely believed it was that decision to lean into the fear of, okay, this might not be the most popular thing to do with the voters, or but it's the right thing to do. Doing the right thing is all that matters, as Marcus Aurelius would say. Again, another person that faced fear and did it with a lot of courage. So we can have like these super role models. Like there's so many out there that I can list that I utilize and that I study and really look towards. But for me, it's the everyday role models. It's my mother. It's my father. It's my brother. It's my sister. It's the other mothers and fathers that are caring for their children or their brothers and sisters, or the person that may, you know, be the, half mother, half father, like that, that didn't, you know, wasn't the one that helped to give birth to a person, but they have adopted, you know, this son or daughter, and they're going to raise them like it's their own. It's the person that, you know, stands up for, to the bullies of somebody that's, you know, being bullied. It's the everyday heroes to me can be the most profound ones. I see this all the time in our staff who are helping people and they're not in the limelight. They're not going to go down in the history books, but they are the most profound in so many ways. There's so many everyday heroes that we have in our lives that are awesome role models for us and how we can face our fears with courage. So these are some of the ways that I have found that have helped me in my life to face the fears that I have. There's more. And again, I'm no expert. I'm still learning. I'm still not always victorious in facing my fears at all. And I have a lot more to learn. I hope that what's been helpful for me can be something that may be helpful for you. That's the whole purpose of me getting out here and saying what I'm saying. This takes some courage, I gotta say, myself, because I know I do not know a whole lot. And what I do share with you all is authentically things that have been helpful for me. I gotta cite Ryan Holiday, who, you know, is responsible for a lot of this information that I've been able to accompany in my life. So he's a guru for me, and some of this information that I've given to you really has been distilled through him. And again, it goes back to role models. You know, who's out there that can really help give us the insights and clarity that is needed to be courageous and to face our fears so that we can live our life to the highest and fullest potential, onward and upward.
Thanks for listening to the Independent Life Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Independent Living of North Central Florida. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe. And if you know anyone who might benefit from listening, share this podcast and invite them to subscribe too. For questions, suggestions, or if you have a story you'd like to share, please email us at cilncf.org@gmail.com or call us at 352-378-7474. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, support, advocate, and empower each other to live the independent life.